Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record as part of the Learning College at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do Chapter 6 of Thomas Dalton's translation of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. Chapter 6 is not that long. It's called War Propaganda. So we'll just make this more of a bite-sized one. It's probably 12, 13 pages. Mein Kampf, Thomas Dalton translation, Chapter 6, War Propaganda. And this will be recording number 9. War Propaganda, Chapter 6 title. In watching the course of political events, I was always struck by the active part played by propaganda in watching politics. I saw that the Marxist socialist organizations knew how to handle this tool in a masterly way and how to put it to practical uses. Thus, I soon came to realize that the right use of propaganda was an art in itself, and that this art was practically unknown to our bourgeois parties. Only the Christian Socialist Party, especially in Luger's time, showed a certain efficiency in the use of this instrument and owed much of their success to it, the mayor of Vienna, Karl Luger, Pan-Arianism. Schirnerer was the Christian Socialist. He's saying the bourgeois didn't know how to do it, but the Marxists did know how to use it. We're masters of the art. It was during the war, however, that we had the best chance of estimating the tremendous results that could be obtained by properly conducted propagandist system. Here again, unfortunately, everything was left to the other side. The work done on our side was worse than insignificant. It was a total failure of the whole German system of information, perfectly obvious to every soldier, that urged me to consider the question of propaganda in a comprehensive way. I had ample opportunity to learn a practical lesson in this matter. Unfortunately, it was only too well taught by the enemy. The lack on our side was exploited by an enemy in such an efficient manner that it showed itself as a real work of genius. In that enemy propaganda, I found admirable sources of instruction. The lesson to be learned from this, unfortunately, had no attraction for the geniuses on our own side. They were simply above such things, partly because they were too clever to learn from the enemy, and partly because there was a lack of goodwill. Had we any propaganda at all? Unfortunately, I must answer in the negative. He's saying that the English and the Marxists totally mastered the art of propaganda, and the bourgeois either thought they were above it, or weren't interested in it, or didn't want to use it, but in any case were completely incompetent. And that extended to Germany as a whole during the war. The Marxists obviously wouldn't use propaganda to help Germany. So he says, unfortunately, I must answer in the negative. We had no propaganda at all. Everything that was actually done in this direction was so utterly inadequate and misconceived from the very beginning that proved not only useless, but at times downright harmful. In substance, it was insufficient. Psychologically, it was all wrong. Anyone who examined German propaganda would see that. We're on page 196 now. There wasn't even clarity about the primary question itself. Is propaganda a means or an end? Propaganda is a means and must therefore be judged in relation to its end. Propaganda is a means. There are a lot of people who will say different things about propaganda. He's saying it's a means, so you have to judge it by its results. It must be organized in such a way as to be capable of attaining its objective. And it's also obvious that the objective can vary in importance from the standpoint of general need, and that the essential internal character of the propaganda must vary accordingly. The cause for which we fought during the war was the noblest and highest that man could strive for. We were fighting for the freedom and independence of our country, for the security of our future welfare, and for the honor of the nation. All the best and biggest and deepest and most vital things is what Germany fought for, and he's going to say this should have been reflected. Despite all views to the contrary, such honor does actually exist, nation's honor, or rather it will have to exist. A nation without honor will sooner or later lose its freedom and independence. This is in accordance with the ruling of higher justice, for a generation of rabble is not entitled to freedom. He who would be a slave cannot have honor. In such a case, honor would soon become an object of contempt. Kind of sounds like the USA and the conservatives without honor, simply doing whatever the Jews tell them and creating slavery for the people they would represent or who accept them as leaders, pathetic as they are. 6.1, the purpose of propaganda. Germany was waging war for its very existence. The purpose of its war propaganda should have been to strengthen the fighting spirit in that struggle and to help bring about victory. But when nations are fighting for their existence on this earth, when the fateful question of to be or not to be must be answered, then all humane and aesthetic considerations must be set aside. These ideals don't float about in the air, but are the product of man's creative imagination. They disappear when he disappears. Nature knows nothing of them. Moreover, they are characteristic of only a small number of nations, or rather of races, and their value depends on the degree to which they spring from the national or racial feeling. Humane and aesthetic ideals will disappear from the inhabited earth when those races that created and upheld them disappear. All such ideals are only of secondary importance when a nation is fighting for its existence. Aesthetic and humane ideals. In fact, they must be excluded from the struggle as soon as they threaten to weaken the nation's power of self-preservation. That has always been their only visible effect. As for humanitarianism, Moltke stated that in time of war, one must reach the quickest decision and that the most ruthless methods of fighting are also the most humane. Footnote 1. Helmut von Moltke, 1800 to 1891, was chief of staff for the Prussian military. Von Moltke, M-O-L-T-K-E. He said the most ruthless is the most humane in the end. When people attempt to answer this reasoning with nonsense about aesthetics and so on, only one answer can be given, that the vital questions involved in the struggle of a nation for its existence must not be subordinated to aesthetic considerations. The yoke of slavery is and always will remain the most unpleasant experience that mankind can endure. Do the Schwabing decadents look upon Germany's lot today as aesthetic? Schwabing, footnote 2. Schwabing is a bohemian and artist district in Munich, not far from the university. And we certainly don't have to discuss such a question with the Jews, because they are the modern inventors of this cultural perfume. Their very existence is an incarnate denial of the aesthetics of God's image. Since these ideals of humanitarianism and beauty have no place in warfare, they must not be used as standards of war propaganda. During the war, propaganda was a means to an end. And this end was the struggle for the existence of the German nation. Propaganda, therefore, should have been regarded from the standpoint of its usefulness for that purpose. The cruelest weapons were then the most humane, provided they helped toward a speedier victory. The cruelest weapons, if they would lead to a speedier victory. And only those methods were good and beautiful that helped secure the dignity and freedom of the nation. Such was the only possible attitude to adopt towards war propaganda in a life-or-death struggle. If those so-called responsible authorities had realized this, there would have been no uncertainty about the form and use of war propaganda as a weapon. It is nothing but a weapon, and indeed a most terrifying weapon in the hands of those who know how to use it. 6.2. Propaganda only for the masses. The second question of decisive importance is this. To whom should propaganda be addressed? To the educated intellectual classes or to the less educated masses? intellectual classes or uneducated masses. Propaganda must always address itself to the masses. Single sentence paragraph with an exclamation point. Propaganda must always address itself to the masses. For the so-called intelligentsia, propaganda is not appropriate, but rather scientific instruction. Propaganda has as little to do with science as an advertisement poster has to do with art. The art of the poster consists in the designer's ability to attract the attention of the crowd through form and colors. A poster announcing an exhibition of art has no other aim than to convince the public of the importance of the exhibition. The better it does that, the better it is. Being meant to impress upon the public the meaning of the exposition, the poster can never take the place of the art on display. They are two entirely different things. Therefore, those who wish to study the artistic display must study something that's quite different from the poster, and it won't be enough to merely wander through the gallery. Again, he's someone who spent a lot of his young life studying art and architecture, as he's told us. The student of art must carefully and thoroughly study each exhibit in order to form a judicious opinion about it. The situation is the same with respect to the word propaganda. The purpose of propaganda is not the personal instruction of the individual, but rather to attract public attention to certain things, the importance of which can be impressed upon the masses only by this means. Propaganda drawing attention to certain things. Propaganda always aimed at the masses, always aimed at drawing the attention of the masses to certain things. The art of propaganda consists in putting a matter so clearly and forcibly, so clearly and strongly, that it creates a general conviction regarding the reality, necessity, and justice of a certain essential thing. So the art is doing all that very simply and powerfully. Not why we mock leftist memes with millions of words, because that's not simple, and thus it's not powerful. So you have to convey in a few images and colors so that something exists is important, and you need to have this attitude towards it. But this art is not an end in itself. The reality, necessity, and justice of a certain essential thing. But this art is not an end in itself. Its purpose must be exactly that of the advertisement poster, to attract the attention of the masses. It should not dispense individual instructions to those who already have an educated opinion on things, or who wish to form such an opinion on grounds of objective study. This is not the purpose of propaganda, which should always go after the masses. It must appeal to the feelings of the public rather than to their so-called rationality. All propaganda must be presented in a popular form. It must adjust its intellectual level to the least intelligent of those to whom it is directed. So the dumbest guy you're trying to reach, you got to make it so he can correctly perceive what you're trying to tell him and sell him. All propaganda must be presented in a popular form. It must adjust its intellectual level to the least intelligent of those to whom it is directed. Thus, its purely intellectual level will have to be that of the lowest mental common denominator among the public it is desired to reach. So that's going to inevitably end up being fourth or fifth grade level, more or less. When it's a question of bringing a whole nation within the circle of its influence, as in the case of war propaganda, then great care must be taken to avoid a high level, which presupposes a relatively high degree of intelligence among the public. And again, he's saying this about Germany, where they have the most educated people in the world, by some measures at least. The more modest the scientific tenor of this propaganda, and the more it is addressed exclusively to public sentiment, feelings, the more decisive will be its success. Don't try to teach them a whole bunch. Just make it clear, simple to a fifth grader what you're saying, what you want them to think. This is the best test of the value of a propaganda, and not the approval of a small group of intellectuals or artists. 6.3, the psychology of propaganda. The art of propaganda consists precisely in being able to awaken the imagination of the public through an appeal to their feelings. that is, in finding the appropriate psychological form that will appeal to the hearts of the masses. The fact that our bright boys don't understand this merely shows their conceit and mental laziness. They tend to want to only value stuff directed at them, but that's not the point of propaganda. It has to be directed at the lowest common public mental denominator. Once we see the need to concentrate the persuasive forces of propaganda on the masses, the following lesson results. It's a mistake to make propaganda multi-sided as if it were a system of scientific instruction. The receptive powers of the masses are very restricted, and their understanding is feeble. On the other hand, they quickly forget. Such being the case, all effective propaganda must be confined to a few bare essentials, and those must be expressed in stereotype formulas so they can be repeated and slightly altered, but the same character carried through, so they don't lose it in their mind, they don't forget it. These slogans should be persistently repeated until the very last individual has come to grasp the idea that has been put forth. If this principle is forgotten, and if an attempt is made to be abstract and general, the propaganda will turn out ineffective. The public won't be able to digest or retain what's offered to them in this way. Therefore, propaganda must follow a simple line. Correspondingly, the basic tactics must be psychologically efficient. It was, for example, a fundamental mistake to ridicule the value of the enemy, as the Austrian and German comic papers did. The very principle here is a mistaken one. When they came face to face with the enemy, our soldiers had quite a different impression. Therefore, the mistake had disastrous results. So when they faced Tommy and his allies in the war, they found, well, they are pretty tough. They're not clowns at all. They are good fighters. Therefore, the mistake in depicting them as silly or goofy or cowardly had disastrous results. Once the German soldier realized what a tough enemy he had to fight, he felt that he had been deceived by the makers of his information. Instead of strengthening and stimulating his fighting spirit, this information had quite the opposite effect. Finally, he lost heart. On the other hand, British and American war propaganda was psychologically efficient. By representing the Germans to their own people as barbarians and Huns, they were preparing their soldiers for the horrors of war and safeguarding them against illusions. The most terrible weapons that those soldiers encountered in the field merely confirmed the information that they had already received, and their belief in the truth of the assertions made by their governments was accordingly reinforced. And their rage and hatred against the vile enemy was increased. The terrible havoc caused by the German weapons of war was only another illustration of the Hunnish brutality of the barbarians, and their soldiers had no time to consider the fact that their own weapons were capable of an equal degree of terror. Thus, the British soldier was never allowed to feel that the information he received at home was false. Unfortunately, the opposite was the case with the Germans, who finally wound up rejecting everything from home as pure swindle and humbug. All this was a result of the idea that any old simpleton, or anyone who was intelligent enough about other things, could be entrusted with propaganda work. And they had no idea that propaganda demands the greatest psychological skill. Propaganda demands the greatest psychological skill. Thus, the German war propaganda gave us an incomparable example of how the work of enlightenment should not be done, and how such an example was the result of a complete failure to take any psychological considerations into account. 6.4. Subjective, one-sided, necessary. From the enemy, however, much could be learned by those who kept their eyes open, whose powers of perception had not yet become sclerotic, and who, during 4.5 years, had to experience the perpetual flood of enemy propaganda. The worst of all was that our people didn't understand the very first rule of propaganda, namely a systematically one-sided attitude towards every problem to be dealt with. In this regard, so many errors were committed, even from the very start of the war, that it was justifiable to doubt whether so much nonsense could really be attributed to the stupidity of those in power. What, for example, would we say of a poster that advertised some new brand of soap by insisting that the competitive brands were good? We would only shake our heads. Exactly the same applies to political advertising. The aim of propaganda is not to try to pass judgment on conflicting rights, giving each its due, but exclusively to emphasize the right that we are asserting. Propaganda must not investigate the truth objectively and, insofar as it is favorable to the other side, present it according to the academic fairness. It must present only that which is favorable to its own side. So propaganda must be one-sided. Propaganda must be one-sided, not fair. That's a different question for others elsewhere, other forums and arenas. It must be one-sided. Present only that which is favorable to its own side. We're on page 200, very bottom. It was a fundamental mistake to discuss the question of who was responsible for the outbreak of the war and to declare that the sole responsibility could not be attributed to Germany. That's defensive also. Sole responsibility should have been laid squarely on the shoulders of the enemy without any discussion as to whether this was true or not. And what was the consequence of these half-measures? The broad masses of the people are not made up of diplomats or professors of political law, nor simply of people who are able to form reasoned judgments about things. Rather, they are a vacillating, childlike crowd who are constantly wavering between one idea and another. As soon as our propaganda made the slightest suggestion that the enemy might have some valid concerns, the foundations were laid for questioning the justice of our own cause. The masses are in no position to discern where the enemy's injustice ends and where ours begins. In such a case, they become hesitant and distrustful, especially when the enemy doesn't make the same mistake, but heaps all the blame on the other side. Could there be any clearer proof than the fact that our own people believed the enemy's propaganda, which was uniform and consistent, rather than its own? And that, of course, was increased by the German mania for objectivity. Everybody became so careful about doing an injustice to the enemy, even at the cost of seriously injuring or ruining his own people and state. So here's a real cultural, if not racial, flaw of the German people, it seems he's pointing out, this mania for objectivity in a world where everybody else is subjective. Naturally, the masses were never aware of the fact that those in authority had failed to study the subject from this angle. The great majority of a nation, this is something I've said 1,000 times, and it is from Hitler, and from observation as well. The great majority of a nation is so feminine in character and outlook that its thought and conduct are ruled by sentiment rather than by sober reasoning. This sentiment, however, is not complex, but simple and consistent. It's not highly differentiated, but has only the negative and positive notions of love and hatred, right and wrong, truth and falsehood. Its notions are never partly this and partly that. So the public is effeminate, is female, and in its mind, everything is either black or white, love or hate. English propaganda especially understood this in a marvelous way, and they acted accordingly. They allowed no half-measures that might have given rise to doubt. Their brilliant understanding of the primitive feeling of the masses was shown in their policy of atrocity propaganda, which was adapted to the conditions of the time. They cleverly and ruthlessly prepared the ground for moral solidarity at the front, even in times of great defeats. Further, the way in which they pilloried the German enemy as solely responsible for the war, a brutal and absolute lie, and the way in which they proclaimed his guilt was excellently calculated to reach the masses. They realized that the masses are always extreme in their feelings, and so this atrocious lie was believed. The effectiveness of this kind of propaganda is well illustrated by the fact that, after 4 years, not only was the enemy still carrying on his propaganda work, but it was already undermining the stamina of our people at home. It's no surprise that our propaganda didn't achieve similar results. It had the germ of inefficiency lodged in it by reason of its inner ambiguity, and because of the nature of its content, one couldn't expect it to make the necessary impression on the masses. Only our harebrained statesmen could have imagined that such pacifistic swill could have inspired the necessary passion that leads men to die for their country. And so this product of ours was not only worthless, but positively detrimental. So again, the English mastered it. They told absolute lies, but they promoted a moral solidarity that black and white, the Germans are the bad guys, and we are the good guys, and it's a fight to the death. We got to kill them. No doubt about anything. And that's what the masses respond to because they aren't capable of much thought or much remembering. 6.5, restriction on perseverance. No matter what amount of talent is employed in the organization of propaganda, it will be worthless if one doesn't take into account of these fundamental principles. Propaganda must be limited to a few simple themes, and these must be represented again and again, repeated. Simple and repetition. Simple themes repeated over and over and over. Here, as in many other cases, perseverance is the first and most important condition for success. Repetition, the key to propaganda. Particularly in the field of propaganda, placid aesthetes and blasé intellectuals should never be allowed to take the lead. The former would readily transform the impressive character of real propaganda and have the Nazi posters in your mind, like showing the Jew peering from behind the curtains that are the flags of the Allies, the U.S., England, and Russia. Show the Jew's big nose and the big, fat, ugly Jew hiding behind them, right? Simple, easily understood idea. Or the white man grabbing the Jew and you know, mucking him out on the end of a pitchfork. Very simple idea, expressed visually. No doubt the Jew is the bad guy. The former, the placid aesthetes and blasé intellectuals, the former would readily transform the impressive character of real propaganda into something suitable only for literary tea parties. People are going to make what appeals to their type rather than what actually works. Propaganda has to be objectively considered as something to reach the masses, he says. If propaganda is about the masses, it has to be simple, it has to be repetitive. And people, intellectual, who are capable of the things the masses are not, are going to overlook that in the attempt to create something that will appeal to their type. That would, if it'll appeal to me, it'll appeal to everybody. Everybody's not like you. You're way above them. The masses are on the level where it has to be extremely simple, black and white, repeated over and over and over. So eventually it sinks into their limited minds, their limited feminine minds. As to the second group, the blasé intellectuals, one must always beware of them because, lacking any fresh emotion of their own, they are always seeking new excitements. Such people quickly tire of everything. They always long for change and will always be incapable of understanding the needs of their fellow men. Very interesting. They are always the first to criticize propaganda, or rather its message, because it appears to them to be outmoded and trivial. They are always looking for something new, always yearning for change, and thus they become the mortal enemies of all efforts to influence the masses in an effective way, because it's too simple and boring for them. The moment the organization and message of a propagandist movement begins to suit their tastes, it becomes incoherent and scattered. It becomes more of a niche thing because they don't represent the masses. They're a small minority. The purpose of propaganda is not to create an interesting distraction for blasé young men. Its chief function is to convince the masses whose slowness of understanding needs to be given time to absorb the message. Only after the simplest ideas are repeated 1,000 times will they finally remember them. Only after the masses see these ideas, the simplest form, these simplest ideas are repeated 1,000 times. I get it, okay. So it's not an intellectual bit of fun for smart people. It's something that is to be very seriously made simple, made repetitive, made absolutely as starkly black and white clear to the public. And that's a job that requires an acutely intelligent psychologist to do it. And the fact that it may not interest you personally doesn't change what it actually is and the only way it can actually be done. 6-6, enemy war propaganda. And this is the last little bit. Like I said, it's not a long chapter, but obviously it's quite important. Every change that's made in the propagandist message must always emphasize the same conclusion. The leading slogan must, of course, be illustrated in many ways and from several angles, but in the end, one must always return to the assertion of the same formula. This is the only way that propaganda can have consistent and dynamic effects. Only by following these general lines and steadfastly sticking to them with uniform and consistent emphasis can we attain final success. One will then be rewarded by the surprising and almost incredible results that such a persistent policy delivers. The success of any advertisement, whether of a business or a political nature, depends on the consistency and perseverance with which it is applied. Here, too, the enemy gave us an excellent example. It confined itself to a few themes which were meant exclusively for mass consumption, and it repeated these themes with untiring persistence. Once these fundamental themes and the manner of placing them before the world were recognized as correct, they adhered to them without the slightest alteration for the whole duration of the war. At first it appeared to be idiotic in its impudent assertiveness. Later it was looked upon as disturbing, but in the end it was believed. After 4.5 years, a revolution broke out in Germany. Its slogans came from the enemy's war propaganda. But in England, they came to understand something further, namely, that this intellectual weapon can succeed only if it's applied on a vast scale. But this success more than rewards the cost. Their propaganda was regarded as a first-class weapon, while for us it was the last hope of unemployed politicians and a cozy job for slackers. All in all, and as expected, its results were zero. So there you go. In one short chapter, he said, this is what propaganda is, and he's used the example, the contrasting example of English propaganda versus German propaganda. The latter was a complete and utter failure for the reasons he outlined, and English was a complete success because they kept it simple and persistent and black and white until they reached the masses, not only in England, but they actually reached them in Germany, where they were fomenting communist revolutions and using the English propaganda themes for themselves. So, wonderful little chapter, ends on page 203. This has been recording 9 out of Thomas Dalton's Mein Kampf, read, discussed by Alex Linder. Find everything at viennainforum.com. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again for more from Mein Kampf real soon.